Welcome to Redemption Fellowship, where our mission is to empower people for life through the gospel of Jesus Christ. We hope and pray that you will enjoy this week's sermon.
And I just want to read two verses, verses 13 and 14. Esther chapter 4. Y'all pray for my mind. I'm gonna step out on faith and not use notes, so I won't be as long as I probably would be using the notes, but I'm still not gonna rush. I'm gonna preach the text, okay? Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14 says, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Amen. You may be seated. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. I want to preach from the title this morning, Don't Forget Who You Are. Don't forget who you are. Now, I got to give you a little background because, honestly, I got to go back to chapter 1, 2, 3 and pull it up to where we are right now so you can get the significance of what's going on, because many of us, we know this infamous phrase, for such a time as this, if I perish, let me perish. But there's much that takes place before Esther can utter these words. For those of you who like reading novels, Esther, this entire book reads as if it is a novel. All of the elements that makes a novel is really contained in the book of Esther. You have a variety of characters that exemplify a variety of character traits. Some are sleazy. Some are sneaky. Some are just downright slimy. You have your antagonist. You have your protagonist. You have action where it's falling action, and that is where the plot slows down enough to where the Lord is trying to show you to come to some type of resolve because there's a truth principle that's being manifested. But then you also have rising action where the plot begins to escalate so fast that the sequence begins to unfold in a way that it reels you in and you can't stop reading until you've read that last chapter and come to the final period. But there's also conflict. Everybody knows that if there's no conflict in a novel, it really isn't a good novel. There's conflict, external and internal. And yet, the beautiful thing about the book of Esther is that it is not a nonfiction novel. It's real. There are real people, real characters that had real experiences. And yet, this book can sometimes be categorized as a tragedy because I believe it's the only book in the Bible where the name of God is, let alone not mentioned. It really isn't even inferred. And yet, God would reveal himself working behind the scenes in the lives of all of these characters, the good ones and the bad ones, in order that his divine purpose can be fulfilled. The author begins chapter 1 by introducing us to the king Ahasuerus, which is his Hebrew name. Some text says Xerxes, which is his Greek surname. And Xerxes is throwing a party, and man, what a party it is. It lasts for 6 months. And all he wants to do is he wants to bring his soldiers, leaders, and different governors from major provinces all over the kingdom so that they can come into his house, show them his most prized possessions, And they can get an opportunity to see the enormity of his wealth. His sole desire is for one thing, is that after they have partied, that they will, at the right time, give him their full support as he gets ready to invade Greece, the only part of the then known world that Xerxes did not control. He brings in his guests, and they are seated on couches laden with gold and silver. They are set out in the garden that is decorated with thousands of white and silver linen streamers that are fastened to marble poles with silver rings. His guests, each one sip wine from golden goblets that have been custom made for this banquet alone, no two looking alike. The floor of his garden is laden with gold and marble, and then there are precious stones and, of course, the mother of pearl. And as the party is at a climax, Xerxes wants his soldiers to be proud of him. He wants the leaders of the territory to look up to him, and he needs his enemies to be afraid of him. But he has a crazy thought in his mind, that all of his golden tapestries and the marble floors and the marble pillars and the silver and the gold and the royal blue doesn't really display his most prized possessions. And so he calls in a few of his leaders and he says, go and I want you to get my wife, Queen Vashti. And I want her to come and I want her to parade down this boardwalk as if she's on a fashion show. And I want her to come out in her royal beauty, but the only thing I want her to wear is her crown. Now, church, the Bible says that Vashti was a beauty to behold. And I tried to find a picture of Vashti. I tried. One thing I know, when you do the topology of where Persia was and where Vashti came from, I can promise you two things. She was not a blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman. Nor was she a fair-skinned brunette. This was an ebony-hued sister. Stacked. Fine. Sure enough, head turn, stopping traffic, fine. And he says, go bring my wife, and I want her to display her beauty and walk in front of everybody in this court, the other kings and the other officials and the other leaders. She is supposed to be their final entertainment at their moment when they are inebriated at the highlight of Miller time. But thank God that a lady knows when she's a lady. Vashti, after hearing this command from the king, to tell the king, I would do no such thing. And as she refuses, Xerxes he's hurt to the core of his being because she has embarrassed him. She has made him look weak at the moment when he needed to look strong. She has made him seem impotent in the moment when his enemies need to believe that he truly has some power. And now his wife, whom he should have had control over, decides to disobey the ruling of the king, and he calls together a few of his servants, and they convene in what's known then as the Supreme Court. So she's not coming. No, sir, she won't come. But what should we do? They came up with a ruling. They said, well, I'll tell you what. Banish Vashti from the kingdom forever. And they wrote this rule and they put an edict out and the king stamped it with his insignia ring and Vashti was banished from the kingdom with no opportunity to appeal. plot thickens. In our absence, Xerxes, he's anxious. Doesn't know what to do with himself. She, no doubt, helped him be the king that he was. She would, no doubt, he don't care if it was in the midnight hour, would whisper the truth in his ears that he needed to hear when he wouldn't hear it from no one else. But now there is no one to keep him in check. There's no one to hold himself accountable to. And he decides in and of himself that now is the time to invade Greece. And he takes about 15,000 soldiers, and for 4 years, they fight in Greece, only to return with about 5,000 soldiers remaining. And in the words of Sophia Petrillo, Golden Girls, picture it. 597, Persia. In comes mighty Xerxes, looking at the golden plated doors of his palace. But this time, as he walks in, his head is low and his body is bent because his spirit has been ripped out of his body because he's lost it in a very tremendous way. His soul is tormented. His mind is wrenching. And let me tell you something. He's longing for somebody that could come and give him some kind of consolation. He doesn't need a soldier right now to stroke his ego. He needs, his heart is longing for Vashti. For she knew how to hold his head and whisper sweet nothings in his ear that would calm his tormented spirit. She knew how to caress his body that would soothe him and bring him from a moment of anxiety down to a moment of calm and peacefulness. She knew the right words to say that would lift his courage and give him his confidence back to be the man and the king that he once was. But Vashti is gone. She's gone. And in comes a few of his, I just got them pictured in my head. They are testosterone-filled bodyguards. Huge, bold. And they come and they stand before the king and they says, "We have a plan. We want to find you a new mate." And he says, "Well, what are you going to do? We're going to search out of the 127 provinces, and we're going to find you a lovely woman that you can once again call your queen." And church, they didn't have high benchmarks. They weren't looking for a lady with maturity and poise and wisdom. They had one requirement. And that is, she had to be drop-dead gorgeous. Yeah. 597. In the city of Susa, the first Miss Universe contest took place. And as all of these ladies and women are being paraded across this platform, in walks this gorgeous woman by the name of Hasada. We know her as Esther. Out of all the women that the king saw, there were some that he rejected and sent back home. There were some that he kept and added to his harem. But out of all the women he saw, he loved Esther. And that brings us to our primary text. They bring in Esther, and for 12 long months, ladies, they pamper her. I mean, Esther is taken from one beauty salon to another beauty salon all throughout the palace of provinces of Babylon. She's have daily manicures and pedicures, and she gets daily massages and steam baths. They took her to beauty school. They relaxed her hair with optimizing, neutralizing conditioning, TCB protein. They put mascara, Estee Lauder, and Fashion Fair, and Mary Kay, and Clinique, and Perspectives. They gave her the most exquisite gowns. And every day, morning, noon, and night, they refreshed her body with the most expensive perfume that money could buy, Clive Christian Imperial Majesty, $215,000 a bottle. Think I'm lying, look it up. The bottle comes in a brown case. Got to have a key to unlock it. And when you open the bottle itself is shaped in a diamond gem and is sealed with gold and silver. $2,000 an ounce. She looked good. She dressed good. She smelled good. But in the height of preparing her for 12 months to learn what it means to be a queen, a new character enters the drama. His name is Haman. And Haman stood head and shoulders above the rest of the men because for some reason Xerxes trusted Haman. He gave Haman all the authority to make what any kind of rule Haman wanted to make. He trusted Haman so much that the king says, listen, here's my insignia ring. That whenever they see this seal, they know it's law. I'm just going to give it to you. No need to check with me when you want to inflict the law. But the king did one thing. He told all the subjects of the kingdom that I want everybody to give their unrelenting respect to Haman. Well, Esther had an uncle by the name of Mordecai. Esther's parents had died. She was an orphan. And Mordecai operated on the old African principle that it still takes a neighborhood to raise a child. That he wasn't going to wait on state assistance or governmental assistance. She was his bloodline, and then no matter what it cost him, she now belonged to him. And he raised her. He instilled principles and values in her. He taught her how to be a Jewish lady, how to be a Jewish mistress, how it is that the Jews would carry themselves and live out their culture. And now she's in the palace. And the edict has come down that everybody must give the undivided respect to Haman. And Mordecai says, I can't do it. Haman discovers it and he goes to the king and he says, King, what would you do if you was going to honor a man? How would you show favor to him? He says, I would put on him the best robe. I would put on him a fine gold ring, and I would put him on my best steed, and I would parade him through the town and bring him in and show him off. He says, Haman thinks, of course, the king is talking about him. But when Haman finds out that the king is talking about Mordecai, this boy gets... Yeah, he's hot. He's hot. He's mad. He conceals his anger. But he has the signet ring and he creates a law. He gives the king a lump sum of money. And he says, King, you have a group of racist bigots living in the kingdom. They are rebellious and they do not respect you. They don't respect me, and they don't respect your laws. So I'm going to pay you to allow me to create a law that on a day that you say, we're going to give every Persian in the country the right to kill every Jew that they see and confiscate their belongings because we need to rid our country of these racist bigots. They put that law in effect, and the news get back to Mordecai. And Mordecai is out in front of the king's gate, mourning and praying. fasting, won't eat. And he dressed up in sackcloth. And the news gets back to Esther, who's in the palace. And church, I don't know for sure, but from reading it, I believe Esther was embarrassed by the actions of her uncle. She says, listen, take him some clothes, take him some food, and tell him to dress himself up, get up and stop acting that way. Don't represent me like that. And Mordecai sends a message back. He said, Esther, baby, I know you're a long ways from home. I know that you're being lavished daily by all kinds of luxuries. And I understand, sweetheart, that when you have these types of good gifts dropped in your lap, that it's easy to forget who you are. And a lot of times you really want to forget where you come from. He says, but honey, don't fool yourself. At the end of the day, you're still a Jew. You're still a Jew. And a moment has come to you, Esther, that if you don't rise up to the occasion, then the Jews are going to be annihilated. And here we are at the beginning of our text, at 11 and 12. And the first thing this Mordecai is trying to teach us through this lesson of Esther is that when you forget who you are, it's easy for you to live a lie. It's easy. Here she is. She's bedecked with the latest hairstyle. She has all of the precious jewelry and gemstones decked out in her evening gown. And Mordecai said, baby, do you think that God has sent you to Persia just so you can accumulate exquisite wardrobe, jewelry and gemstones? Do you not understand that beneath all of that mascara, beneath the eyelashes, beneath the perfume and the elaborate evening gown, that the blood that runs warm in your vein is Jewish blood? And baby, don't you think for one moment that just because you're in the king's house, that when that law is passed that all Jews are to be killed, that you are going to escape by yourself. When you forget who you are, it's easy to live a lie. I was watching Tavis Smiley. I usually don't, but for some reason, I just turned in and watching Tavis Smiley. And he started talking about how even now in America that we are segregated now by classifications. And he started talking about the upper middle class Americans. And when he did the statistics, I said, Lord Jesus, what a lie we've been fed. Because some of us ain't mad with nobody, first of all right? Now, I know how talk goes, but I'm just putting it out there. I ain't mad with nobody, but I'm going to say what I'm going to say. Some of us feel that just because I can walk in these Ivy League schools and get educated, that I can leave the hood and the project and can live in the suburbs. That I can bake where I want to bake and I can drive what I want to drive. That I have arrived. I'm upper middle class African American. But if the truth be told, especially the ones who want to be snooty and don't really have it. No. Because I'm telling you, I've seen some upper middle class Americans. They got it. It's just a normal lifestyle for them. But for those of us who really don't have it, and we think we got it, as snooty as we can be, and guess what? The only classification we fit is upper middle class debt. When you forget who you are, it's easy to live a lie. Mordecai says, baby, those people in the palace, you think they're colorblind. But they got a way of letting you know that they know that you are a Jew. And when the moment that you forget you are a Jew, they got a way of reminding you that you are a Jew. Y'all know I ain't lying about it. On some of these plantations where you go to work, they'll let y'all play golf with them. And they'll bring you on the golf course and they'll say, you are surely different from the rest of them. You are a tribute to your race. And you begin to act like you better than the rest of us. But guess what? I don't care where you've been educated. I don't care where you live. I don't care what you drive. I don't care what your position is. I don't care where you bank. America will let you know that you are still black living in these United States of America. And the only reason we get trapped up in that nonsense is because we have forgotten who we are. Some of us don't want to hear our history. That's why, Brother Wynn, I ain't stop you from singing, man. I went way back home as a little boy worshiping. Oh, yeah, when Big Mama, I know Big Mama didn't have nothing but a third grade education. But she taught me a long time ago that Jesus can save your soul, and not only will he give you eternity in heaven, but he'll do some wonderful things for you here while you're on earth if you trust him. She didn't need a college degree to know that. When you forget who you are, it's easy to live a lie. I can only imagine how difficult it was for our ancestors enduring slavery in this country. There were many other forms of slavery, but the worst in history was slavery in America. And I can only imagine the hell that our people went through. But you know what? I'll never forget my history. I won't let their history die. I won't let the licks that they've taken. I won't let the blood that they've shed. I won't let the bruises that they've incurred die. Because I thank God for my ancestors. We come from a strong people, men and women, who would not allow the system to break them. Shame on some of us that when we get a few letters behind our name, don't say no common me to him to me. I can read. You don't even know who you are. You can't know who you are unless you know where you've been. And there's something wrong with us that we become embarrassed of our own people, that we won't even celebrate the 1 month, God forbid, that this country give us called black history, when we have to be black every day of our lives. But that's what happens when you forget who you are. You begin to believe that, you know, I'm better than Big Mama and them. I was reading Sojourner Truth, She wrote a poem because she decided that she would not allow America to define her as a slave. I want to read it to you. The title of the poem is "Ain't I a Woman?" See, I wish, Alisa, you did. Who did you do the other day? You did Harriet Tubman. So, Alisa, I felt sorry for you up here. I said, God, dog, Lord, she looked like a slave. She was sounding like a slave. You betrayed us. You betrayed her. But. So Joanna Chu say, she said, well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of the kilter. I think that twist the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights. The white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all they're talking here about? The man over there says that that woman need to be helped in the carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me in the carriages or over mud puddles or give me the best place. Ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered in the barns, and no man could head me. Ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lash as well. Ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most of them sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. Ain't I a woman? There they talk about this thing in the head. What is it they call it? And somebody from the audience says, intelligence. She said, that's it, honey. What they got to do with woman's right and Negro's right. If my cup won't hold but a pint, and yours hold a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then these little man back there, he says, woman can't have as much rights as men, cause Christ wasn't a woman. Well, where did your Christ come from? Where did Christ come from? He came from God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, then these women together ought to be able to turn it back upside right. And now they are asking me to do it. The men better let them be obliged to go on for hearing. And right now, old Sojourner ain't got nothing else to say, but ain't I a woman? When you forget who you are, you easily become what they call you. Esther is in the palace, and she's in a prestigious position, and she has learned that the livelihood of their race is about to be extinct, and she tells Mordecai that I can't go into the king because he hasn't summoned me in the last 30 days. And he says, girl, you better recognize who you are. Don't let all of that pampering and all of that stuff and gifts that's been lavished upon you fool you. Because when this law is passed, honey, your head will also be on the chopping block. When you forget who you are, it's easy to live a lie. But the second thing it teaches us in verse 14, he says, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's house, family will perish. But who knows that for such a time as this, you have come to this royal position. When you forget who you are, you fail to live up to your purpose. There are moments in biblical history where God would allow things to happen to people. Like Esther, you all remember the story of Joseph and how evil his brothers treated him, all because his father lavished upon him a coat of many colors. They took Joseph and laid him in a cistern and told the father he's dead. Only years later, they go to Egypt, and there is Joseph ruling the kingdom. And at the end of the story, Joseph tells his brothers, after he reveals to them who he really is, they're crying and they're worried. He says, well, don't worry about it. What you meant for evil, God meant it for good. And what Joseph is truly saying is that for such a time as this, God has placed me here at the head of the kingdom for the salvation of my own people. And now, here is Esther. She thinks that the only reason she's come to Persia is so that she can have these good gifts lavished upon her and that she can live the life of a glamour girl. But Mordecai, he keeps twisting and he keeps prodding. And he keeps reminding her of who she is, and the purpose that although God's name is not mentioned, that he understands that God is somewhere divinely working behind the scenes, and that's what providence is the invisible hand of God that's always active in life and in our moments, that even when we don't see God, he's at work doing something for our benefit but for his behalf. She begins to try to renege on her uncle. And her uncle has to remind her, sweetheart, the Lord didn't send you here so that you can become some Barbie doll queen. God has a purpose, and it's time now for you to rise up to the occasion. For maybe, Esther, you're in the position that you're in. Because I know God knew the moment was coming. And he wanted to use you in this position. Esther, come on now. Remember where you come from. There's no way that you could be living in the area where you live growing up, in the poverty that you grew up in, but all of a sudden, of thousands of women, you're the only one picked out to be groomed to become the queen of the king. Maybe you think that's by chance. You know, that's how it is with some of us. That when the Lord elevates us, we don't see it as God. We think, well, you know what? My hard work got me here. Me staying up late, me meeting and greeting with the right people, hanging around in the right meetings, saying the right things, doing the right things, got me here. But have you ever thought that maybe you are where you are? Because God wants to do something through you. You know, all the time when good things are lavished upon us, and not necessarily for us exclusively. I mean, truly, come on now. All you got to do is truly think about your life. And think about your history. And think about where you come from. I know me coming from Penny Farm, that when I graduated from college, there weren't but two people in Penny Farm that had a college degree. That was me and another young lady. Two. And then to come to old Ivy League Columbia and to graduate at the top of my class, I know that was nobody but God. Come on, y'all, I could barely speak English. You talking about being able to go in and ace Hebrew and Greek? That wasn't nobody but God. And I can remember being in the chapel. I'm sitting there like the rest of them. Everybody praising. I'm sitting there. They quiet. I'm quiet too. And after about a year in school, my mama called me and said, look, Reverend Frank wants you to come back home and preach. I said, okay. Go back home, and they start singing those old common meters. I couldn't sit still. I'm on that pulpit, and I'm praising God, and the Lord said, now, if you can praise me here in New Bethel, in Penny Farm, Why you can't praise me in that chapel in Decatur on that college campus? When I got back to the campus, yeah, they were quiet, but I told them, look now, I can't worship in silence. I'm worshiping God. I got to lift up my voice and elevate it because I ain't here to praise you. I ain't here to satisfy you. I'm here because God brought me here. When you forget who you are, you fail to live up to your purpose. And I thank God that all throughout history, God has brought up people that he could say for their lives that but for such a time as this. I read where Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, I think it was 1863. And Booker T. Washington was 7 years old at the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves. At the age of seven, he was too poor to go to school. He worked in a soap furnace and coal mines to help the family be supported financially. But he had one dream. And that is, he wanted to be educated. At the age of 16, Booker T. left home. 500 miles away, he went to school at Hampton Agricultural Institute in Virginia. 500 miles away. You know how he got there? He walked. He'll ride to school with 50 cents in his pocket. And when he got to school, they gave him a job as a janitor to pay for his schooling. When it was time to go home on breaks, 500 miles, Booker T. walked. When it was time to get back to school, 500 miles, Booker T. walked. But he graduated, and at the age of 25, he became the first black to be the president of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And the students begin to gather around Booker T and they say, look, Dr. Washington, we got a plan. He said, what's your plan? He said, we want to get educated and we want to get good jobs. And we want to make the white folk our slave like they made our ancestors their slave. He said, no, that's not the plan. Mm-mm. He said, because slavery is wrong for any people. He said, let me give you a plan. He said, now, we're going to come to the table, but what we're going to do is we're going to make the table. And we're going to make the table with such architectural design and appeal that they're not only going to invite us to the table, but they're going to invite us to the table that we built. In 1909, he came to the table. The first African-American to have dinner with the president at the White House, Teddy Roosevelt, bought Booker T. in. And he sat down at the table that they had designed at Tuskegee Institute. And before he left, the president said, listen, I need to hire you as part of my cabinet. He said, what do you want me to do, Mr. President? I want you to go out and I want you to find men and women that has character and qualities like yourself. And I want them to become head of states and governments and countries. Help me to help them to make America a better place for such a time as that. God raised up a Booker T. Washington. And all along our history, God has raised up people from crucial moments in life, that when it seems like the end was about to be snuffed out, God always had a ram in the bush. Mordecai said, Hester, baby, this is your moment. This is your hour. Now, what you do with it, baby, it's up to you. But you have an opportunity to save millions of Jews if you can only remember, baby, who you are. One last thing. And that's down here in the verse 16. God evidently has touched her heart. And she says, go gather all the Jews who are in Susa. And she says, fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. And my attendants will fast also. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish. This last verse teaches that when you forget who you are, you value your life more than God's plan for your life. You get it? You value your life more than God's plan for your life. Many of us are just too selfish. Lord, what's in it for me? If it's going to inconvenience me, if it's going to cut into my time and my agenda, then I don't have time for it. But out of the same breath, we'll say, giving honor to God who is head of my life. Well, if he's head of your life, when does whatever he asks you to do becomes an inconvenience for you? If you know who you are, but more than that, whose you are. It is only then that you can come to the conclusion that Esther says, I know what I'm about to do is against the law. But eternity is at stake. And if I perish, then I perish. Now those are some wonderful words, but she didn't reach those words overnight. It took some prodding from Mordecai, and it took, I'm sure, God to deal with her conscience. He had to wake her up to who she was and help her understand, girl, by you being in the royal position that you're in, this is not happenstance. This thing is bigger than you. But if you value your life, your luxury, your wardrobe, your lifestyle, more than my plan for your life, then you will let your people die. But if you understand that I have a greater plan and a greater purpose, and that the life that you have is because of me, you too will say, if I perish, I perish. And I love what she does. She says, I'm anxious about this thing. I'm really fearful. But I tell you what, if you all will pray with me and fast with me, let me know that I have your support and your fellowship. Then with my entire life, I will risk my life to go before the king and let him know the plan that has been made. And if I perish, then I perish. This Black History Month, I couldn't close Black History without reminiscing of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Had a dream. Not just for human rights for blacks, but human rights for human beings. He was strong enough to call out white pastors, he says, for those of you who are saying that the plight of the Negro, the way that we are being mistreated, is just a sociological problem, how in the world can you stand in the same breath and talk about God as good? It's a shame on you. But he also said to those of us who are in the struggle, we don't need to do anything illegal either. We need to come together and join hands with our white brothers and sisters, those who understand that our mistreatment is wrong and that they can't be free until we are free. And together, we can make a new America. And I know Dr. Martin Luther King knew that his life was coming to an end. He knew it. He knew it. Look at his speech. I've come to the mountain. I've been to the mountaintop. He knew it. But yet, I can hear him saying, like Esther, if I perish, let me perish. He was in New York, and this demented black woman comes up to him, and he says, she asked me one question, are you Martin Luther King Jr.? He says, yes. And the next thing he knows, there's a knife pierced in his side. And let me read what he says. He says, and then while I was on my hospital bed, they in New York, they put out in the newspaper that if I had sneezed, I would have died. And he said he received the letter, and the letter said, dear Dr. King, I'm a ninth grade student at White Plains High School. And she said, while it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing to say that I'm happy that you didn't sneeze. And he said, I want to say that I'm happy that I didn't sneeze. Because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around in 1960. When students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in American dream. They were taking the whole nation back through these great wells of democracy that were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation and interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten up their backs, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your bike unless it's bent. Amen to that. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963 when the black people of Birmingham, Alabama aroused the consciousness of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had the chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down to Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. Oh, I'm happy that I didn't sneeze. But it really doesn't matter to me now. I don't know what's going to happen. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't really matter to me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind like anybody else. I want to live a long time. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he has allowed me to go to the mountain. I looked over and I've seen the promised land. And he said, I might not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people going to make it to the promised land. He said, I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And that's what Martin Luther King was saying, if I perish, then I perish. God has given me a dream, and I want to see humanity come together that they can live in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that God had created them to live in. And if I lose my life for it, then let God's will be done. When you forget who you are, you value your life more than God's plan for your life. Mordecai says to Esther, baby, this is your chance. God can use whomever he wants to use. But Esther, what if God chose you for such a moment as this? You know, I think many of us are going to die with several regrets. And that is because we will be more concerned about fulfilling self as opposed to fulfilling God's will and God's purpose for our lives. And I repeat it, I said again, I won't forget the struggle of our people. As long as I'm alive, it will be alive. But Stephon, you weren't there. Yes, I was there. I was there. If it happened to them, it happened for me. And I got other folk that would say, well, man, you know what? I didn't discriminate against y'all. I wasn't back there. Yeah, you were. I wasn't there when Adam and Eve sinned. But their sin is applied to me. I'm not able to back out because I wasn't born at that time. You're not able to get off the hook because you weren't born at that time. This is our history. It happened to our people, and they're a part of us, and we're a part of them. Therefore, it belongs to us. Don't forget who you are. Don't forget where you come from. Listen, reach the stars if God will let you reach them. Drive the fanciest vehicle you can drive if God will let you drive it. Live in the fanciest house that you can live in if God would allow you to do that. Ain't nothing wrong with that. God ain't even against none of that. But whatever you do, don't forget who you are. But more importantly, don't forget whose you are. God bless you. Come on.
Thank you for listening. We believe God is up to something new here at Redemption Fellowship. And we invite you to please come and visit with us here in the beautiful city of Fayetteville, Georgia. If you would like more information, please contact us at redemptionfellowship.org. Once again, we hope that you have enjoyed today's message. And we can't wait to see you here worshiping with us.